Today, can Vice Presidential nominee Kamala Harris re-energize Democrats? How different is this year's convention from past Democratic National Conventions you've covered?
It's so different. I'm not even in Milwaukee because Joe Biden is not in Milwaukee.
This week, the Democratic National Convention is underway in Wisconsin. And Guardian U.S. political correspondent Lauren Gambino is covering it from her apartment in Washington, D.C.
Everything is virtual. We're watching on live streams and on TV, which is just so bizarre because usually you're in the room surrounded by, you know, thousands of the party elite and party faithful. But none of that this year. You won't see any of that. You won't have the famous balloon drop. So it's all different. It's strange.
The pandemic has upended or eliminated many of the normal election year rituals, but it didn't diminish the buzz of anticipation around Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's vice presidential pick.
All eyes on Joe Biden, with just over a week until the Democratic National Convention. Biden says he'll pick a woman as his running mate, but beyond that, it's anyone's guess.
And Biden's decision to name California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate has injected new energy into the race.
We have a president who cares more about himself than the people who elected him. A president who is making every challenge we face even more difficult to solve.
From The Guardian, I'm Mythili Rao. Today in Focus, could Kamala Harris help Joe Biden clinch victory in the presidential election? Lauren, I know a lot of Democrats were excited when Joe Biden said he planned to pick a woman as his running mate. And then not only did he pick a woman, he picked a Black woman and an Asian woman, the daughter of immigrants from India and Jamaica. Just how historic of a moment is this?
I think you can't separate his choice from the moment that we're living in. The nationwide protests in response to the police killing of George Floyd has just given rise to such an important movement in the U.S. And that was no different from Joe Biden's choice of running mate. He faced a lot of pressure from Democratic women and Black women in particular. And in the aftermath of his decision, you're just seeing this outpouring of women and people of color saying, it is so incredible that I'll finally see myself reflected on this ticket. I think it's really helped excite Democrats around this ticket.
And you were there for Harris's first appearance with Biden in Wilmington last week. What was that like?
Please welcome Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris.
It was really different, as you expect, because of the coronavirus. So it was just Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and a few members of the press. You know, they took the podium.
Thanks for being here. I wish we were able to talk to the folks outside, but we're keeping our social distancing and playing by the rules.
Joe Biden, I think he really laid out the case and his rationale for choosing Kamala Harris. He wanted someone who was going to take the case to Donald Trump, someone who is a sharp debater, who's got a dynamic campaign style, and who he felt like he could trust, who reflected his worldview.
I have no doubt that I picked the right person to join me as the next Vice President of the United States of America, and that's Senator Kamala Harris.
She took an opportunity to sort of preview what the next 90 days will be before, less than 90 days now before the election.
This is a moment of real consequence for America. Everything we care about, our economy, our health, our children, the kind of country we live in, it's all on the line.
There was probably close to 200 people who did come out just to glimpse them. They knew they weren't getting into the auditorium, but they wanted to just see Harris. And there were plenty of signs that said, you know, representation matters or Black Lives Matter. Thank you, Kamala. It was clear that she brings a sense of energy to the ticket.
And one way to measure that energy and measure that response to the decision is by looking at the fundraising figures. In the hours after the announcement was made, just how much money did the Biden campaign bring in?
They brought in about $26 million in 24 hours.
So we set a single day record for online political fundraising. And I think I know why.
Harris was known as a fundraising juggernaut even before she was picked. She was, you know, the Democratic National Committee loved to feature her name on fundraising tickets. That is clearly still the case.
And for listeners who are a little less familiar with American politics, it's probably helpful for you to explain, at this stage of the process, what exactly does a vice presidential nominee do?
So a vice presidential nominee has a few different roles. Harris specifically is going to be the quintessential attack dog. That is often the role VPs play, and they are also very defensive of the top of the ticket. So in this case, Joe Biden. He's hoping that she will speak personally and with authority on issues of police reform, of racial discrimination, racial inequity. You know, he's also been criticized for his speaking style. You know, he'll admit he has tendencies to sort of ramble and go off the script.
We choose science over fiction. We choose truth over facts.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men and women created by the go, you know the thing.
We have this notion that somehow if you're poor, you cannot do it. Poor kids are just as bright and just as talented as white kids.
That is the exact opposite of Kamala Harris's approach. She's sharp. She's very pointed. And so I think they want that contrast. There's also generational contrast. Harris is 55, but, you know, decades younger than Joe Biden. You know, for all those reasons, I think she helped round out the ticket.
To that attack dog point, we've spoken before on this podcast about how Biden has really been campaigning from his basement so far. So in terms of campaign strategy and the kind of events they do in the next 90 days or so, what will change now that Harris is on the ticket?
I was talking to the campaign a little bit about this. You know, they're very observant of public health guidelines. And so I don't think we're going to go back to what we consider normal campaigning. The campaign wants to make the point that they're following the science, following public health guidelines. We'll probably see more events. We'll see them together. But I don't think we'll have rallies unless the U.S., you know, contains the virus somehow.
That would be a dramatic plot twist.
Right, exactly. And that would definitely reshape the campaign for sure. But until then, I think you're going to see probably more of the same small events featuring the two of them.
And the Democratic National Convention is already underway this week. It looks very different from past conventions for all the reasons that you explained. What's expected from Kamala Harris's speech tomorrow?
She's expected to make the case against Donald Trump and to really make the case for Joe Biden. And that's a crucial element of this because in 2016, there was this feeling that Democrats tried to make the case against Trump, but they didn't make the positive case for them. And so I think that will be a piece of this. I think the campaign is hoping that you'll see, look at this star. Don't you want to be a part of this movement?
What is her story? Can you tell me a little bit about Kamala Harris's upbringing?
Kamala Harris is the daughter of immigrants. Her father was from Jamaica and her mother was from India.
My sister, her mother, went to U.S. in 1958. Whatever Kamala is today, the credit goes to my sister and no one else.
She was raised mostly by her mother, her and her sister, in Oakland, California.
My mother, who raised me and my sister, was a proud woman.
Kamala Harris likes to say that she had a stroller's eye view of the civil rights movement. Her parents were very active in the civil rights movement in Berkeley, and she says she remembers attending protests and demonstrations, and that's sort of the through line of her life story. Ultimately, she was mostly raised by her mother, and she says that her mother, Indian American woman, raised her knowing that she was raising two Black daughters in America, and so she wanted her daughters to know their worth and know their place in America. And when she was old enough, she applied to go to Howard University. It's the oldest historically Black university in the U.S., and that's sort of the start of her political rise.
So that was her childhood in Berkeley. And then, as you mentioned, she went on to Howard University in Washington, D.C. From there, she headed back to California for law school, and then she started her career as an assistant district attorney in Alameda County. From there, she sort of rose up the ranks. She became District Attorney of San Francisco and then Attorney General of California. And I think it's this chapter of her career that really gets the most scrutiny, her years as a prosecutor. What was her approach to that role?
Since the primary, Harris has struggled to reconcile her past as a prosecutor with the current movement for criminal justice reform. And, you know, at issue is that she was a prosecutor and it was her job to send people to prison with sometimes very long sentences. And, you know, obviously in the U.S., the criminal justice system is disproportionately made up of Black and Brown Americans. And so there's a few specific policies that are often raised. There was a truancy program which threatened to prosecute parents if their children missed school as a way to encourage parents to make sure that their kids were attending school.
I would not be standing here were it not for the education I received. And I know many of us will say the same thing. And I believe a child going without an education is tantamount to a crime. So I decided I was going to start prosecuting parents for truancy. Well, this was a little controversial in San Francisco.
That seems to be the one issue that's really dogged her. But she's also been accused of not holding police officers accountable for misconduct or police killings during this period of her career, or being too friendly to the police. I think what's interesting, though, is she was also, there was a certain case where she refused to call for the death penalty for someone who murdered a police officer, and that actually lost her a lot of trust and support among the police union in the state. So she will defend herself by saying she was smart on crime, that she was a progressive prosecutor, and that, of course, in the light of 2020, is something that she's having to grapple with and try to explain what she meant by that.
Now, Senator Harris says she's proud of her record as a prosecutor and that she'll be a prosecutor president, but I'm deeply concerned about this record. There are too many examples to cite, but she put over 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and then laughed about it when she was asked if she ever smoked marijuana.
Have you ever smoked?
I have.
Okay.
Like I inhale. I did inhale.
I will say a lot of that criticism has seemed to dissipate in the last few weeks. I was actually surprised to see the number of progressive groups that sent out statements just ecstatic over her nomination. And these are groups that, you know, might have previously criticized her and that in 2016 did not hold back their disappointment with Hillary Clinton's choice of vice president. And so I think it's just a reflection of how much has changed since these nationwide protests broke out and how Kamala Harris has become a voice on these issues. And I think whether progressives trust the evolution, we'll see. But at least as of right now, she seems to have convinced the Democratic Party that she is an advocate for criminal justice reform, police reform, and is pushing a series of laws in the Senate that would do that.
It's so interesting because I've seen people, like you said, both criticizing it and also seeing in her someone who's willing to grow and change and move away from past positions. I mean, in this political moment, do you think it's confusing for voters that she's not someone who's always had a very clear ideology? Or does that make her appealing?
I think that's a really good question because it's not just on criminal justice. We also saw it specifically on healthcare, which ended up being a critical issue during the Democratic primary. Early on, she embraced Medicare for All, which is Bernie Sanders' universal health care plan.
Let's give the taxpayers of the United States a better return on their investment, which means Medicare for All.
And then as she got into the primary and she realized there was these very rigid ideological polls between Joe Biden, who's very moderate, and Bernie Sanders, who's progressive and far to the left, she didn't fit either. And so she backed away from this health care plan. She said she no longer supported it in that way and introduced her own version.
But in the end, in the summer, you came out with a plan you're calling Medicare for All, but it would keep private health insurance.
I have always supported Medicare for All. I was very happy to sign on to Bernie's bill, and I give Bernie, frankly, a lot of credit
for moving the conversation to where it is now, but I thought we could do better.
Which obviously critics said was absolutely not Medicare for all and not universal health care. And so she dealt with that, trying to evolve on an issue. And she's explained it by saying, look, I support what works and what can get done. And I'm not ideologically rigid. That's not who I've been. I'm more of a pragmatist. And I looked into universal health care for my campaign, and we just found that it just wouldn't work. And we came out with our own plan. So I think Joe Biden's campaign is hoping that because you can't pinpoint her on the ideological scale, that she might appeal to these voters who might not be Democratic voters traditionally, but who are so fed up with Trump that they're giving the ticket, you know, a second look. And because she's not a Bernie Sanders acolyte, that is going to appeal to a lot of voters who are independent or consider themselves more moderate. And I do think she has been strong on several other progressive priorities like immigration and LGBTQ rights. I mean, this is a California senator. She's born and raised in California. So on a lot of issues that are important to progressives, she is fairly strong. So I think in that way, she can kind of float between these two poles. And the campaign definitely was aware of that when they chose her and are hoping that she can have the sort of broad appeal, not just across the Democratic Party, but to moderates and to independents who are wavering between Democrats and Republicans.
And we haven't really talked about her time in the Senate yet. Like you said, she's been a Democratic senator representing California since 2017. What kind of senator has she been?
I'd say if you ask the average person what they know about Kamala Harris in the Senate, they would definitely tell you it comes down to a few very high-profile Senate committee hearings. I think one of the earlier instances was when she was questioning Jeff Sessions.
Did you have any communication with any Russian businessmen or any Russian nationals?
I don't believe I had any conversation with Russian businessmen or Russian nationals.
Are you aware of
Although
any communications?
A lot of people were at the convention. It's conceivable that somebody came up to me.
Sir, I have just a few.
Well, you let me qualify it. If I don't qualify it, you'll accuse me of lying. So I need to be correct as best I can.
I do want you to be honest.
And I'm not able to be rushed this fast. It makes me nervous.
And, you know, she was actually chided early on. She was chided by the Republicans on the committee for being too aggressive, effectively. And that turned out to be, as you might expect, a rallying cry for women. They thought, you know, stop trying to silence her. She's doing her job. And she continued with that style and that approach even before the allegations emerged around Brett Kavanaugh. She tried to draw him out on his relationship with Donald Trump and Trump's lawyers.
Yeah. How can you not remember whether or not you had a conversation about Robert Mueller or his investigation with anyone at that law firm? This investigation has only been going on for so long, sir. So
right,
please
I'm not sure
question.
I'm just trying to think, do I know anyone who works at that firm? I might know.
That's not my question. My question is, have you had a conversation with anyone at that firm about that investigation? It's a really specific question.
I would like to know the person you're thinking of, because what if there's...
I think you're thinking of someone and you don't want to tell us.
She also asked him to identify any laws that restrict the male body in the way that there are laws, you know, obviously referring to abortion, that restrict what a woman can do with her body.
I'm happy to answer a more specific question. But
male versus female.
There are medical procedures.
Okay. That the government has the power to make a decision about a man's body?
I thought you were asking about medical procedures that are unique to men.
I'll repeat the question. Can you think of any laws that give the government the power to make decisions about the male body?
I'm not thinking of any right now, Senator.
She knows how to capture these moments that, you know, maybe in this day and age will go viral or at least draw some national attention and can be used in fundraising appeals.
In her first appearance with Biden, Harris said that she's had many titles over the years, but she claimed that the most important one to her was Mamala, and that's what her husband Doug's children call her.
Family is everything to me, too. And I cannot wait for America to get to know my husband, Doug, and our amazing kids, Cole and Ella. Because whether I'm cheering in the bleachers at a swim meet or setting up a college room dorm, or helping my goddaughter prepare for her school debate, or building Legos with my godson, or hugging my two baby nieces, or cooking dinner, Sunday dinner. My family means everything to me.
How important do you think it is in 2020 for an ambitious woman to signal to the public that she cares about normal domestic things and has a normal family life?
I thought about that a lot too. I think no one will say this explicitly, but there are questions about whether some Americans will vote for a ticket in which the oldest president ever in American history would be succeeded by a Black woman. And then on top of that, she's a Black woman with a blended family. She has stepchildren. Her husband is a white Jewish man. You know, there are all these questions that shouldn't matter that do in American politics. And I think she wanted to just get in front of the questions that will inevitably come about her family and will probably be asked in a way that maybe distinguishes her from what we've seen in the past, which is, you know, we've had two female vice presidential candidates before and one female presidential candidate, and they've all been mothers, and they've all had to emphasize that they are mothers as part of their appeal to voters so that voters see them in that role. You know, we know that research shows the likability question works against women. Women have to prove that they're qualified, and they tend to be more qualified than their male counterparts just because of these hurdles that exist for women in power and female politicians.
We've seen Trump's camp try to suggest that Kamala Harris isn't eligible for higher office, basically in a repeat of the birther claims they made against Barack Obama. What other sorts of attacks have the Trump campaign launched against her?
Kamala Harris ran for president by rushing to the radical left, embracing Bernie's plan for socialized medicine, calling for trillions in new taxes.
They've launched a pretty scattershot attack on Kamala Harris. On the one hand, they're accusing her of being a radical left-wing Democrat who, you know, is from this liberal bastion of California and is going to bring in all of these far-left policies. On the other hand, they're also trying to stoke divisions within the Democratic Party by saying, but remember, she was really tough on crime. And, oh, but also remember once she sparred with Joe Biden on the debate stage. And so they're really throwing everything at her, I think, to see what sticks. They also struggle during the primary to really figure out how to go after her. Trump never really landed an attack on her. And you'll see recently Trump has called her nasty, which is one of his favorite insults for his female opponents and female critics.
I thought she was the meanest, the most horrible, most disrespectful of anybody in the U.S. Senate.
But we know that that sort of energizes women and rallies women around the person he's insulting.
You mentioned that unforgettable moment during the primary debates when Harris really challenged Biden over the issue of busing and his record on that.
I do not believe you are a racist. And I agree with you when you commit yourself to the importance of finding common ground. But I also believe, and it's personal, and it was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
It was a moment that really showcased Harris's strengths, both as a tough prosecutor and as someone who really knew how to deploy her own backstory in a political context. At the time, Biden was reportedly pretty hurt and taken aback that she'd really gone for him in that way. But presumably, he decided that those skills would make her a pretty big asset to his campaign. Is that what happened?
First and foremost, Biden's been in national politics for decades, so he understands political combat. But he was hurt. I mean, Biden is someone who he does sort of bookend his career by saying he decided he wanted to come into politics because of the social upheaval after the assassination of Martin Luther King. And now he's asking to be the president in a time, again, of social upheaval over race and racism in America. You know, I think that specific attack really, it just went to the core of what he thinks his career has been about.
If you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't black.
It don't have nothing to do with Trump. It has to do with the fact I want something for my community. I would love to see
you. Take a look at my record, man. I extended the voting rights 25 years. I have a record that is second to none.
All that being said, I think he's hoping she'll use those same exact skills against Mike Pence and Donald Trump in the final weeks before November. And so I think they're really hopeful that you know, now that they're not on the receiving end, that she'll both be able to defend Joe Biden with that same ferocity against Donald Trump and also go after Trump.
I mean, the other thing that was so powerful about that moment was here you had a candidate for president on the national stage talking about her own lived experience with busing as a little black girl, giving that really personal sense of how these laws and issues affect a person's life trajectory. How has Harris used her identity and her personal story to try to connect with voters in this moment where all political conversations are dominated by Black Lives Matter and America's reckoning with race?
In recent weeks, we've seen her speak very personally on the Senate floor about what it means to be Black in America. Kamala Harris had led legislation to make lynching a federal hate crime, and it was held up by one Republican senator, Rand Paul, pretty much on a technicality. He thought it was written too broadly. And she just walked onto the Senate floor and let it all come out. She was so upset that there wasn't this unanimous recognition of why lynching should be a federal hate crime.
Senator Paul's amendment would place a greater burden on victims of lynching than is currently required under federal hate crimes laws. There is no reason for this. There is no reason.
Coming up, what this means for the future of the Democratic Party. Biden has talked about how in this election cycle, he's a transitional candidate. What does he mean by that phrase?
I'd say the prevailing view is that he's not set on running for a second term if he wins in November. And that's why there has been so much attention around his choice. That would mean that his vice president, Kamala Harris, would be next in line. She would be sort of a de facto successor to Joe Biden in 2024, possibly 2028. For a lot of Democrats and liberal-minded Americans, there was a period in which it seemed like the U.S. was on this forward march. There was 8 years of Barack Obama, the nation's first Black president, and then Donald Trump was elected. And it felt like, for them, the country was going backwards somehow, that progress was at risk of being erased. And I think Biden, who was Barack Obama's vice president, I think he recognized that there's a need to show these voters and these Americans who really fear going backwards that we're still moving forward. There's still progress happening.
The civil rights struggle is nothing new to Joe. And today he takes his place in the ongoing story of America's march toward equality and justice as the only who has served alongside the first Black president and has chosen the first Black woman as his running mate.
By choosing Kamala Harris, and possibly not just as a running mate, but a potential successor, he's showing there will be progress.
Lauren, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Lauren Gambino. My thanks to her. Today's episode was produced by Sam Colbert and Courtney Youssef. Sound design by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.